When there's harmony between the mind, heart, and resolution, then nothing is impossible, says the Rig Veda, which is the oldest and biggest among the Vedas. It is the oldest compilation of human wisdom currently available in 10 mandalas or books. It was not authored by a single person, and it is believed that it has contributions from 329 rishis and 27 rishikas. The mantras contained talk about various gods, the five elements, the rituals, and the philosophies of life. Hello, my name is Malati, and today I am with an acclaimed author on this show titled The Impressive Empress. It gives me immense pleasure to talk to these women leaders who have started a humble journey and have gone a long way to break many myths and beliefs to impact the society in a positive way. The idea behind this show is to understand what it takes for a woman to become a leader, to understand the journey from within, the journey to becoming a female leader with a higher purpose. Our guest for the day is Sahana Singh, an author and commentator based in Etaha in New York State, USA. She's an environmental engineer by qualification and writes on a variety of issues including Indian history, water management, and education. Her first book, The Educational Heritage of Ancient India, How an Ecosystem of Learning Was Laid to Waste, has been appreciated for awakening Indians to the role played by India in spreading knowledge around the world. Her second book, titled Revisiting the Educational Heritage of India, explores in greater depth the subject of India's unique ecosystem of learning, which created a knowledge-centered society and laid the foundation of the major academic disciplines being pursued today. An alumnus of Delhi Technological University, Sahana made a career shift to writing after moving to Singapore. She worked as an editor of Asian Water magazine for many years and has won several awards for journalism till date. Her articles have been published in the Reader's Digest, Washington Post, Discovery Channel Asia, Asian Water Magazine, Swarajya, India Facts, and other publications. I'm extremely delighted to have Sahana today on this show talking to me about confidence, self-control, and spiritual strength. Hello, good evening, Sahana. Hope you're doing fine.
Hello, good evening. I'm fine, thank you.
It's very great to have you on our show, The Impressive Empress, where we talk to women leaders from various walks of life, trying to understand their journey to success, their journey, the inner journey that makes the person who they are and they were, that makes them create the social impact, the huge impact that they create in the societies and communities they live. So, once again, welcome.
Thank you for inviting me.
Yeah. Sahana, could you briefly introduce yourself, please?
Okay. I think I already have let you know my professional credentials, but essentially I'm an Indian, I'm a Hindu, and I'm a very curious person who's looking at the world with wonder, making discoveries along the way and documenting it. I think that's who I really am, always finding something to be very full of wonderment about, you know, marveling at something around me and finding happiness. So I'm always looking for happiness and being happy with whatever I get, but always treating it as a quest. So I'm on a quest to discover new things and know, make sense of the universe. So I think that's who I am.
Great, great. I've read a lot of your articles. I keep reading them. I've become a big admirer of your writing, to be very honest. Irrespective of the topic, you know, you write on a wide range of topics, like, you know, being a civil engineer, of course, you have a lot of interest in the environment also. You write about water, the Indian history, the rich Indian heritage, about education, whatever it be. Somewhere you always bring a note or two on the ancient Indian knowledge systems. What is it that brought you closer to the Indian history and heritage, living far away from the homeland?
I think it was that aspect of living far away, because that is when you are in India, you don't really think much about who you are, right? Your identity. But when you step out of India, and that is when you are viewed as an Indian by the rest of the world, and then they ask you questions. So it is often it was driven by the questions that I would receive. Like, you know, somebody is asking me, what caste do you belong to? And then I would be surprised. Okay, so they view us in terms of the caste system that we have in India that is so widely known around the world that they look at us through those lenses. Such things, you know. And also when I stepped out of India, initially it was in Singapore. And that time too, I used to be very mystified by the names like Singapura, Indonesian language itself is called Bhasha. So I used to see these Sanskrit words everywhere. So these were mysteries. Why is Thailand, why are they so Hindu, but they don't really call themselves Hindu, but they worship Ganesha. They have streets named after Rama. So those things used to fascinate me. But I had kept those questions aside for a while because that time I had a young child to take care of. I had a job. But as we went along and then when we came to the US, that is when I actually really went deep into these questions that I was getting. And I looked at my daughter's history textbook as well, the world history textbook. That was an eye-opener because when I saw what they say about India, it shocked me. Because they just saw India as a land of poverty, as a land of suppressed or oppressed people, where there were negative cultural practices like sati and caste system. That's all that they saw about India. And that surprised me a lot because, you know, I have always been proud of our culture and heritage because I was keeping in touch with the writings on history, the alternative history as well, not just what we were taught in school. So then when I saw that India was being misrepresented so much in the history textbooks, I think that's when I really started taking an active interest in reading what I could lay my hands on, speaking to my parents, my mother, trying to understand why do we do this custom? Is this really exclusivist? Is this really excluding women? And then I would get the explanations, which made a lot of sense to me, but that would not be reflected in the books that were, the popular books. So I think that brought me close to the history and the culture, and I began to write about it. Initially, I thought I don't have the authority to write on these topics because I'm an engineer. I should only be writing about engineering, water problems, water sector. Those were the subjects I was writing about. But as I started writing about India, I found that it was connecting with a lot of people. Even though the things I was writing was actually not the first time it was being spoken about, but still people were so fascinated as if it was the first time they were hearing about it. And so I realized that maybe I'm putting it in a way that goes across, that is understood very well. And so that's how I started writing more about it. That's how everything, it's suffused into every writing of mine. Even when I was writing about water or engineering, I would often bring in the cultural worldview, the Indian Hindu cultural worldview, which was always the voice of wisdom. So that's how it all started. Still continues.
Very nice. I mean, I think you have taken the flair for writing from your grandparents, I would say. I read a little bit about it. I think you're a great admirer of your grandfather, who's popularly known as GKT or GK Timmanacharya, a great Sanskrit scholar. And you had written in one of your articles that your grandfather had helped many of his students to develop self-control, spiritual strength and confidence. You, and only you, can control your mind, he would tell them. And don't blame others. Take charge of your life.
Yes.
When did you know about the importance of self-control? And what habits did you develop to bring about self-control or controlling your mind?
I think it's about what I see in others. So if I saw somebody who doesn't have self-control, I have seen a lot of such people, and I would think, I don't want to be like this person. I would always admire people who were dignified, who were in charge of their lives, managing everything, not complaining. So it's basically what you see and what you admire is what you want to become, right? Of course, parents are there to tell you that this is not the way to think, this is not the way to behave. So I think at a very young age, most of us Hindus are told that controlling the mind is the most important thing. I think that's a very, that's a prerequisite of a Hindu family, because they would tell you something from the Gita, something from Mahabharata, from the Vedas. So they will tell you again and again that your mind is the most important tool, and you have to have it in your control. If you lose it, then you are nothing, right? So I think that that is something that I kept hearing. And then when you get to those stages of life, the ashramas of life, after marrying, you have a child, I think that is when the real responsibility comes. Because now you have somebody to take care of. You have to take care of this. This child depends on you. And that's when you realize the importance of keep being together, your mind and your body, everything is together, so that you can take care of this little human being and make this person, bring this child to teenage, to adulthood, and give values. So I think that's, it started early. But life itself teaches you to be controlled, because you get respect from people when you are that way. If you lose your temper, lose your control, you will not be respected in your job. You'll not be given responsibilities. So it is something you would learn anyway. But I think being a Hindu helped me a lot, because there are texts which tell you about this. Bhagavad Gita teaches you about it. So I think that's the journey I had of knowing, seeing what I want, what I like to see in people, and being helped by the texts that we had to learn from.
You make it sound so simple. Actually,
no, there were challenges, and I never say that I've actually learned to control. I mean, this is an ongoing thing, right? Life will throw challenges at you. Just when you think you've got a control and you know you're in a good place in life, then life will throw you a challenge. Like, you know what I've recently faced. So then you yourself have to, I mean, there's no way you can be bogged down, as a failure. So you have certain goals in life. You want to do something that I think makes you get up again and again. I think that's also one thing. If you remember what you want to do in life, if you keep reminding yourself, that will make you get up, control yourself, and get on with your life.
Mm-hmm. Can you share some of the habits, everyday habits, that you have inculcated in your life to help you stay in charge of yourself?
I think, of course, I do try to get my full sleep. I'm very particular about getting my full sleep. I used to try and make it 8 hours, but nowadays it's not more than 6 or 7. But I try and get my sleep. And with food also, there is, though I do have a sweet tooth and I love to eat sweets, but there is some, that voice at the back of my head, which keeps telling me not to eat this, not to eat that. The other habits are, I think, of course, all the usual hygiene and everything. But also, I think breathing, that is something that I've been reminding myself to breathe, pranayama, because I've been neglecting that for a while, but that is now becoming a part of my lifestyle. Waking up in the morning and doing my puja after bath, the daily little bit of puja that I do, sitting in front of the deities, I do everything at that time. I do my breathing also at that time. I light a lamp. The lighting of a lamp is another thing which I felt has brought a lot of peace to me, and it makes me feel good. Because even traditionally, women, you had this responsibility of keeping the light always burning. Whether it was the kitchen fires or it was the lamp, you had to keep it burning all the time. So I think when I light a lamp and keep looking at it, as I'm breathing, as I'm meditating, various, and then doing the puja, I think it gives a sense of balance. And that is one habit I think I would like to highlight. That we do something, some little traditional practice every day, which helps us to be grounded, rooted. And it's also a time when I kind of give my problems away. I say that this is not, I hand it over to the higher power and say that you are going to solve this for me. It's not my problem. So it's a kind of self-talk that I do to myself. And then I get up completely refreshed and I'm able to handle the day.
Nice. It's very simple. It can be followed by anyone. And
yes,
I love that. That's a practice that anyone can take right. up.
Of course, I would love to include more things in this, like exercise, and all that. I do that every now and then. But ideally, yes, there should be a whole 1 hour of yoga. So even if I can't do that, I get into that, but some, it goes off when, some, there's a change of place. then that stops. But I've kept the puja part alive. I keep doing that.
It sounds very positive. I mean, you also mentioned that you have a very positive attitude towards life and you would like to make people happy. Now, to bring a positive change is something that many of us aim to do. But you keep doing that almost on a daily basis through your writing, through your interactions with people and communities. Now, we seem to be caught up in the motions of our life and hardly take the time to appreciate many little things in life. For example, I remember you mentioning in an interview that we need to be grateful to the cow that gives us milk. I do agree that thinking in a positive way can help lead a more positive life and therefore contribute more to the society. But how does one build that kind of a positive mindset?
I think again I would have to go back to our Hindu texts, sacred texts, because I think that itself is the recipe for positivity. It builds a sense of gratitude. So whatever, you know, you might be sad or anything, but if you count the blessings, there are many, many blessings. You just cannot say that there's nothing good in my life. So, I mean, when I count the blessings, I find that I'm counting and counting and counting. There's so many things. I mean, having food to eat, having a body that is functional, having a house to live in, having friends, having parents. I mean, so all those things, being grateful already gives positivity. So that is, I think, one way I do it. All the chanting, all those things also build the positivity. And then, of course, that curiosity and sense of wonder. So you will not be negative if you're curious about something, you're trying to learn. If you're a student all the time, you're always learning something. Either you're learning a language or you're trying to, understand history or you're trying to learn something else. Then you will be positive, because how can you be negative when you're on a growth phase, when you're always learning? I think that's one of the things I do. I'm being busy. I mean, you should not be having nothing to do during the day. So you have to have hobbies. Music, of course, like I love classical music. So I'm sure everybody can have something which is related to art and culture, which gives them happiness, positivity. So when I listen to a good piece of sitar, you know, a lovely piece played by Pandit Nikhil Banerjee, or I listen to flute by Pandit Hari Prasad Chaurasia, that half an hour of listening, just listening, you know, with your mind completely on that music, you come out of it and you're positive. The world is so beautiful. So that, I think, has also helped me a lot. Loving music, loving art, loving beauty in nature, being curious, having faith, all those things helping being positive.
And of course, enjoying the simple food such as idli dosa with sambar and avial,
everything. I mean, I love food, of course. I can't claim to be a good cook. But yes, when I cook, I do cook with that feeling that, you know, whatever I cook has to be good and I have to enjoy it and everybody has to enjoy it. So every act can be a positive act. You can, whether it's cooking or going out for a walk, looking at things around you. Of course, we are blessed. We are living in a beautiful place. It might be harder if you are living in a slum or you are living in a polluted place. Those things would be harder. But when I go back and remember, I think even when I was in Delhi, which is very polluted, even in those times it was polluted, I was always having fun. Going by bus to college, I would have a hanky tagged around me to prevent the smoke from getting in. Everybody would be laughing at me in those days. But I would be observing the accents of people, how they talk, and also the sense of humor. I think positivity also comes from seeing the humor in everything. I think that also I would put as something which helped me a lot. I see humor in everything.
That's a very, very positive trait, actually, to be able to laugh at things and laugh with others.
Right.
I think you have this ability to connect with people and a genuine desire to see them happy is what I think. Yes. But exploring India's history has become the central mission of your life, you had said. Your book, you have written two books. The Educational Heritage of India has gained instant acceptance, like you also mentioned, your writings. Your books cover a vast time span from ancient Indians' traditions to the deliberate destruction of the heritage. It definitely must have taken a humongous effort on your part to bring this acceptance to your books. Was there any magic, or what aspect of you as an individual, especially as a woman, helped you connect with people?
I think it's empathy, because I'm empathy and curiosity. When I see somebody, I don't superficially talk to them just to be nice. You know, you have that over here. I see a lot of that fakeness when people talk. They just say hello, but they're not, how are you? But they're not interested in knowing how you are. I mean, if you start answering that question about how you are, they are not interested. They just say, how are you? That's just for saying something. But I genuinely want to know how people are when I'm talking. I want to know how they're doing. Are they happy? What's going on in their lives? So I have that. That helps me to connect. And then because I read a lot, I would know something about their culture or their job. And that is also a starting point for me to ask questions. And so that's one thing about me. I ask questions about them. That brings an answer, and then that leads to a further conversation. So that's how I connect to people. And then, of course, I do like people. I mean, I can see that everybody has something good in him or her, and something to teach me. I come away from talking to somebody, learning something about that person or the country or the culture, whatever it is. So that is how I think I connect very easily to people. It wasn't always like this. I remember when I was quite quiet. In fact, some people used to think I'm proud and arrogant when I was younger.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that that was probably just shyness, maybe. As we talk more, we lose that shyness as we go out into the world. So that's when I started talking. Children especially, you know, I love to talk to children to see what they are thinking about, what excites them, what are their hobbies. So those are the ways in which I connect to people.
Yeah, I think there's a genuineness that comes out, and that kind of builds the trust in them that, yeah, we become more trustworthy.
The genuineness, sincerity would always be appreciated. Yeah, that's the main goal.
But amongst all this, you must have also received a lot of criticisms. How do you stay afloat in spite of all of that?
If it is genuine criticism that I can learn from, then I feel happy. Sometimes I do get that. A lot of times I do get that. So that, you know, something that you wrote was not correct. Are you sure that, you know, the original author meant this? What is your, you know, then they make me dive deeper into it. Then I come out with an answer to either defend myself or to accept that I was wrong. So that takes me on another learning journey. But yes, when there is unfounded criticism that comes from jealousy or from not knowing me, or, you know, attributing wrong meanings to me, that can be upsetting for a while. But then again, as I told you, because I have a sense of humor, many times when these kind of criticisms come, which are not founded on anything, it becomes very funny for me, because I realize where it's coming from, that somebody is jealous and is saying this. And so then I laugh it off. So I usually laugh it off. And then because I have a family, I have a real life, I have people who love me. So then all those things wear off. And of course, I do have a lot of discussions when I get criticism for what I've written. Then I end up talking about it with my husband, my daughter, my parents, everybody. We have discussions. Then there comes a conclusion, and then it's put to rest when I have addressed it. So that's the way it works.
Yeah. But all of this can also bring you a lot of mental fatigue. You might get bored or even burnt out. I mean, that's something that people often experience as a writer. If your work is not accepted, then starting from just getting drained to a mild depression or to something more serious could happen. What do you do to stay above that?
Yeah, I think when, you know, we have to accept it. We have to, when we read the biographies of people, we'll realize how much they have failed so many times. Well, any successful person, whether it's a musician, author, filmmaker, industrialist, scientist, you will see that they've all failed so many times. I think it's about knowing that when you fail, it is still a step forward. I think that is how you have to take it. So yes, you're talking about that mental, the writer's block, maybe when you are not able to progress. That can be, yes, that can, what I do when that happens is, when I'm burnt out, I'm feeling tired, is to move away from it all, basically close everything, take a break, just not think about it, do other things, watch movies. I love to watch movies. Just do other things and then come back to whatever you are doing. And then maybe, you know, that, and of course, if you're burnt out, you have to also look at your health. I mean, I'm probably not getting enough sleep. I'm not probably relaxed enough to think straight. Maybe I should not travel so much, cut down on the travel. So those questions get handled when I feel tired or burnt out. But mainly, yes, art and culture, music would help. Drama, theater, all these things would help to again put it, you know, bring back all that lost energy.
Yeah. And added to that, you're also a very spiritually rooted person. And I think that also helps you give the right kind of orientation, if I may say that.
Yes, that spiritually oriented and being having that faith will always make me know that this is not the end of the world. This is not the end. There is new doors will open, new roads will open. So that feeling of security comes from believing in a higher power and having that daily ritual where you connect with the higher power.
But I would like to dive a little bit deeper into this aspect of failures and setbacks. You know, living in the VUCA world, you know, the last couple of years have been, you know, more than that. Everybody faces setbacks or failures at some point or the other. While some emerge stronger out of this, others find it hard to accept the harsh realities of life. Can you talk about how you handle failures? You did tell that you discuss in your family, but if you could dive a little bit deeper into this aspect and help the listeners, how can one handle failure? It's very hard. I mean, for some, like I said, they can brush it away. They can think positive and say, okay, there's been a learning in this and then I'll get up and move forward. But for many, especially women, it's difficult. So how do you handle failures? What are some of the tips that you can give and help others?
No, I think what I would do is, if it is a failure, what kind of failure? I mean, is it a relationship failure or is it something in the profession? You have to take a step back and try to analyze it. You have to see whether it is because you are in a line that you should not be in. Maybe you're not competent enough. Maybe you need to change your field. So those questions you have to answer. Are you passionate about what you're doing? I think so. There has to be that logical question and answer first. And then you realize that, okay, maybe I need to try more. I love what I'm doing. I have to keep trying harder. So then you proceed in a certain direction. But you have to first sort out those things. Or if it's a failure in a relationship, you know, whether you should be in this relationship or not, those basic questions have to be handled. Of course, I haven't faced that, but I'm talking about others who would be in that situation. But yes, I mean, there are downs that I've faced sometimes. In fact, I would say that in my younger days, you know, there was one time when I went to Delhi to study. I'm from Calcutta to Delhi. And I had a huge problem finding a place to stay because in those days, you didn't have girls' hostels so easily available. So for studying engineering in Delhi College of Engineering, there was no girls' hostel. So I had to stay with different relatives. And that was really not a good time for me because I knew that I was not welcome beyond a certain time. And I was assured at the time of admission that there would be a girls' hostel being completed and we could stay there, but it wasn't made available until like almost 2 years passed. So I had to stay in, and that was, I tell you, the biggest wake up call or the biggest growing up, you know, coming of age thing for me, because I realized that all those things you have, you know, illusions about people and things about life, you know, you're out of your parental cocoon and then you're facing the world. So that is the time a lot of things happen. And I remember even in those times, I think I still had faith. Because I was still speaking to my parents and they were telling me not to give up and tomorrow will be a better day, keep trying. And so, I mean, now I think of some children today, if they face that, they'll probably leave. They would give up that course itself. They won't study because not having a place to stay, you would rather leave everything, go back to your parents. But I just kept going on and on and on and said, trying to, you know, somehow taking it all, even though I'm staying with those relatives and I don't know if they're happy or not. I mean, even if they're not happy with me, I have to, there's no way, I have to somehow manage, right? And then ultimately I got a place to stay, a hostel. And then ultimately a few years later, my parents came down, themselves came because my father got transferred. Everything got good again. So you know, that assurance that this is a phase. There has to be that self-talk where we tell ourselves that this is just a phase. Everything in life is just a phase. This is not forever. So I think that understanding really helps. And in health also, when there is a health setback, that's something you have to tell yourself, that things will get better. We'll not always have this pain. You will not always be fatigued. You will not always be having this fever or whatever. So I think that is there. The self-talk. Basically, I think for failure, you have to first see your options, whether you need to take a different track, a different route in life, maybe apply for a different job, whatever it is, withdraw from whatever you're doing and do something else. But then also you have to assure yourself that there is light at the end of the tunnel. That is self-talk, and you, for that, you have to do whatever it takes. If you need to go see a doctor, you need to see a mental health doctor, a psychiatrist, why not? That might help you. I know some of my friends do that. They have been very helped by going to counselors. So that route can also be taken. Marriage counselors or any kind of counseling, your mental health counseling. And I think whatever it takes, if it's about having a talk with somebody, you need to have a heart-to-heart talk with somebody to come out of this situation, then do it. Face it. Say what you want to say. Don't keep it bottled in your mind, I would say. And then compassion. I mean, have compassion when you are looking at the situation. Whoever, you know, you are blaming for something, holding that person responsible for the failure, just have a bit of compassion and see whether that person is also in a helpless situation or what is it. I mean, look at all aspects of the matter and then decide what is the best way to do. Go ahead. But I think inside we all have it. We know what we should be doing. It's just that we are not connected with that inner guide within us. I frankly feel there is nobody external who can help you. You have to connect to that inner guide within you, that inner philosopher, inner seer, and then you will know what to do. But never give up hope. I mean, hope is something essential. Never give up hope, because you are here in this life for a purpose, and you will discover the purpose if you have not done yet. So just keep going. Just put that one foot in front of the other and keep going forward. And a time will come when the answer will reveal itself to you. You will know what to do. That's what I believe.
Beautiful. I was going to ask you how to build resilience and tenacity, but I think it got answered there. Listen to your inner guide or the inner seer.
Yes.
So things will open up. But as a woman in the modern writer's world, how do you find your treatment as a woman writer?
Well, in the profession that I was in, there were women. But yes, if I go early on, when I became an engineer and I worked for some time in an oil refinery in the environmental division, there were some hardships. For example, there was no women's toilet in that building in which I was working. And every time we had to go to another building, the main building, to use the toilet. Those kind of things were problematic. But in India, I never really felt that kind of discrimination in the sense that, oh, you are a woman, so you will not be able to do this. You will not be able to handle this. That was not there. Maybe because other women before me had fought those battles. They must have fought those battles, because we do read about them. The first woman who got a job in a certain company and all those things. So for me, the experience of being a woman has been actually quite positive, except for that bathroom thing. Everywhere, I mean, the bosses used to be nice. They would be considerate. Yes. The other problem, of course, was, you know, the menstrual cramps used to be a bit of an issue, which is not talked about. So if you have that, you won't say that the reason you're not feeling well is that you have menstrual cramps. Mm-hmm. I think that used to be a bit of a problem. So one would try to take leave at that time, or, you know, you would just... So I wish there was a way that we could get around this. Talk more openly about this, maybe get somebody to help at that time and be open about this. I think that would be good. today's generation, I don't know how they are managing with this, but I think it's a problem that still continues. People are not able to talk about this.
Absolutely. I think it's still a problem that women are not able to talk about it openly. And
it's not just in India. I mean, sometimes it's projected as if in India it's a taboo. Of course not. It's everywhere. I mean, in the US, in Europe, anywhere.
You don't
see women talking about this.
Women don't want to talk about it. Men don't want to be understanding about it is my feeling. Yeah, sometimes.
Professionally, I didn't have any problems. So even as an editor of Asian Water, I was doing my job, traveling, doing my work. I didn't face any problems. Mm-hmm. Even otherwise, but again, I know it depends on the profession you're in. I mean, if you are in a hardcore engineering profession, maybe women have to make their voices heard and, you know, speak out. But I think ultimately, you know, women should not be complaining. They should just do what it takes to get, you know, be there, do what they want to do, right? Use the power of communication to the maximum. Be smart, be clever about it, and then get your way. I think they've always been doing that. And today it's so much better for women than it used to be long ago, right?
Sure.
Of course, in ancient India, I must point out again, since I always bring that, women were doing it in those days. Most of the jobs were home-based. So the men, women, children, everybody would be involved in doing that work, which would generate revenue for the family business. Yeah. So it's a new phenomenon, I would say, that, you know, you're facing all these barriers.
True. But any interview with a woman leader would not be complete if we do not talk about work-life balance.
Mm-hmm.
It's always an interesting point for talking and for people who are listening also. Could you please talk about how you managed it, being a mother, being a professional writer, especially as one who's an avid traveler and who likes to connect the dots across societies, civilizations, and disciplines? What are the sacrifices you had to make at each stage of your career?
So when I look back, when I joined as an editor of Asian Water, I joined first as an assistant editor and then went on to become the editor. In those days, initially, I was actually going to office 9 to 5, working there. But then came a time, and I'm so grateful for that, that I was able to get the opportunity to work from home. So that mine is a very unusual case. So I was able to work from home, but again, you still need that balance. Even from home when you work, there is a tendency for people to think that you are working from home, so it's not, you know, you are still available. You know, people can say any, talk to you anytime, they can walk into your room, they can ask you anything. So I had to make those boundaries that, you know, from this time to this time, nobody is going to disturb me. Manage your problems yourself. So this is something that I had to make everybody understand, my husband, my daughter. In Singapore, of course, I had the advantage that there was domestic help over there. So I had somebody to help, but even that needed management. I could not just leave it in the hands of this person and think she'll know what to do best. So, yeah, I mean, it needs a bit of a mental space, a lot of planning. I think you have to really plan very well to have a good work-life balance. So if you're very organized, you're very well planned, I think there'll be lesser problems. And if you're very good in communication, you're able to say what you want and what should be done, then it's easier. But if you are failing on those fronts, everything will get messed up. So you have not planned that you will stay longer in the office and you have not informed people what they should be doing. You know, then things can really go wrong. But I see that most women are able to come up with a formula where they are able to manage it. And then, of course, for the emergencies, you have to take the day off, whatever it is. The child is sick, you know, you have to do that. You have to do what it takes. So if there's a deadline that cannot be met, you have to inform that this is what has happened. People will understand. The problems come if you don't communicate. You're not communicating what the issues are and they don't know what the problem is. The people who are expecting your work to be completed by a certain time. And then you don't show up or you don't do the work. That is something that women have to be careful about, because all of us women are being judged every time. So we have to, one woman messes up, then they'll say, oh, women are like that, right? That happens. So I think this is probably a pressure that a lot of women carry. So I think it can, you have to work around it by being good in communication and planning. And the rest is, you know, things will take care of itself. The other things that I mentioned, having, being positive, being happy, making sure that you do things that you like every now and then. Make sure you. I think women should keep that, be strict about that space that they want for themselves. They should, otherwise, you know, women being very kind and giving people, there's a tendency that they will be taken advantage of. It's a very inherent quality that women have. That they like to help, they like to serve, they like, so, but they have to tell themselves that, no, I don't need to do this all the time. I need my space. I'm going to sleep for this much time. Nobody should disturb me. So those boundaries have to be set. So I did that. I would be very angry if people didn't let me sleep, or I would let them know that, you know, I'm taking my rest, you can't. And I will not disturb you too. When you are doing your work, I'm not going to disturb you. You have to not disturb me. So you work along, you work on that, and then you achieve that. But I don't think you ever get a perfect balance. There'll also always be some more of something, more of work and less of life, or more, you know, it'll be like that. You keep working on it. I would never say that, you know, I found the perfect solution. Kept working on it and it worked. It didn't fall apart.
Yeah. Eventually things will fall in place.
They will fall in place. Yes.
Yeah. I have this very interesting question from someone I know with whom I shared that I'm going to be talking to you. Mm-hmm. It's about the environment, since you really love to talk about that. Many people read contradicting information on how best a common person can do their bit for the sake of environment. Do you have a tip for those wishing to contribute their little bit to Mother Earth on an everyday basis?
I think it's about becoming minimalist. The lesser you consume, the more you're doing for the planet, because we have become huge consumers. So I used to find it very ironic when we would talk about water management and saving water. One of the things I would keep hearing is save water, save water. Now, that's a very superficial way of looking at things. That, yes, I mean, of course, use less water for what you're doing. But the real thing is consume less, because every product that you use uses water, uses resources. So the more clothes you have, the more pots and pans you have, the more furniture you have, anything, everything comes through a process, through the factories, and then over there a lot of water and a lot of resources, energy, various other things are used. So we should try to buy things which are of high quality that we can use for a very, very long time. So not buying low quality products that you throw away very soon. I think that must be avoided. So if there's a single thing you should do for the environment, I would say use less, be minimalist. And if you want more clothes, then give away your clothes to somebody who needs them. And don't be shy of using used clothes yourself. Like I often do that. I actually tell people that, for my daughter, because she was growing tall very quickly, I used to tell all my cousins that, you know, hand down all those clothes of your children that are in good condition, give them to me. I don't want to buy new clothes for my daughter. So I did that quite a bit. And people used to be surprised. Oh, don't you mind wearing this? Her wearing this, she has worn it 100 times. I would say, no, I don't mind it at all. So there will be a few new clothes, but the others were all clothes that were worn by her older cousins. So that's the way I did with clothes. Other things also, you can always do that. You know, you can... For furniture, you know, try and buy secondhand furniture, and your own furniture, try to give it away. So that's the way I think. Try to have as less impact on the environment as possible. The other things will fall in place. Using less water for dishwashing or for clothes and all that. That you will nowadays get equipment which helps you to do that anyway, right? So I think that's the answer I have.
Yeah.
Be mindful of your lifestyle. Be mindful about everything you do and see what is the environmental impact of what you're using or what you're doing.
Great. Great piece of advice on that. Now, to conclude, I have one very important question. It's more like my favorite question. How do you define success?
Success. Oh, yeah. That's a very good question. I think I define success by the amount of happiness you have got. And I also define it by what are you passing on to the next generation? So if you have learned a lot, you have done a lot, but what have you What are you, are your children also going to carry forward your ideals, your values, and your work? Or have you inspired a good number of people to carry forward your work? So for me, success would be discharging those runas, you know, the debts. Again, I go back to the Hindu analogies. You have a debt towards your teachers. You have a debt towards your parents. You have a debt towards the devatas. So there are many different kinds of runas that you have. So that discharging them to the extent possible, I think that would be closer to, that would give a definition of success. So if I have learned a lot, have I taught it to a number of people? Have I mentored enough people? And if I have got a lot of love for my parents, from everybody, then have I passed on that love to other people? So those are the yardsticks that I use for defining success.
That's a very unusual definition I've heard so far, and that's simple, but still very amazing definition of success. So thank you so much, Sahana, for taking this time out and joining us and sharing your life's journey of building all the skills that you have built to have this wonderful career where you are writing so much about so many beautiful things.
And thanks to you also for, you know, asking these questions and making us think.
Yeah. So I'm happy that you enjoyed this conversation, and I wish you all the very best for the year ahead.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you so much for listening in. I hope you liked this conversation and found it inspiring. If you think this could help transform minds, please feel free to share this podcast widely in your networks. You can listen to the Impressive Empress podcast on iTunes, Spotify, Amazon Music, Google Podcasts, Podbean, Stitcher, TuneIn, JioSaavn, and Player FM. Got a question that you want me to ask our next guest? Do write to me at empress@bhogya.online. empress@bhogya.online. That's it for now. Bye until the next time, and take care.